Hey, everybody, it's Jay Hursko, your on-again, off-again host of the Agile Uprising podcast. We just want to give our loyal listeners a heads up that we had some audio issues with quality in this episode. There was a little bit of background noise and some interference. We tried as best we could to wash it out. However, it may be a less than optimal listening experience. We did have a fair amount of internal debate about if we should even release the episode, but based upon the subject matter, we feel that it was a good conversation. We are going to give it a shot and hope that you listeners do enjoy what you hear. Once again, thanks again for all of your dedication and your constant listening. We enjoy the feedback. We enjoy doing these for the audience, and we hope you enjoy the show. Thank you.
This is Alistair Coburn. You're listening to Agile Uprising Podcast.
So welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am this evening's co-host, Jay Hursko. Joining me are Brian Lockhart, Andrew Left, and Jason Cusack. And the topic for this evening is we are going to have a roundtable discussion around the recently released version 1 11th Annual State of Agile report. For those of you that don't know, we do have a link to this post on the Coalition. It is a yearly survey of all Agile practitioners, companies from all different types of industries. And what we're going to do is talk through some of the data points that bring up some interesting questions about what we see in the trenches as practitioners and try and add some color commentary around what we're seeing and does this survey accurately represent what we're seeing in real life? First of all, thank you, gentlemen, for joining me, and let's begin. So as we're scrolling through the report here, the first thing that jumped out at me is there's a call out about distributed agile teams. It's fairly early on in the survey, and the data point is 86% of the respondents to this survey had at least some distributed teams practicing agile. Now, I wanted to see what you guys' thoughts are. Is this something that you're seeing? Does this number sound about right for what we see in here? And what does this mean for the future? Ryan, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the most important things when we talk about, when I read the term distributed teams, I think virtual teams. And I think it's Lizette Sutherland Mark Kirby that famously made the quote that if you have one virtual team member, you have a virtual team. So the reality is more and more you're going to see distributed teams. And the fact that 86% of the version 1 respondents said that they're working in a distributed environment does not surprise me in the slightest. I'm surprised it wasn't even higher. I have about 35 folks in my program that I work with day to day, and every single one of the teams that we have in there are not 100%, but to some degree are distributed or virtual teams. So it's right in line with what I'm experiencing. Actually, it's a little bit lower than what I'm experiencing.
Jason?
Yeah, I was surprised it was not higher, to be honest. And the way that I interpreted distributed teams was if you had team members in two different buildings, but they weren't co-located sitting next to each other in like a team space, that's what I considered distributed. And I feel like the things that I've seen at all the different organizations I've been, I mean, co-location is really more of a luxury than anything else. And I just haven't seen it a whole ton. I think that with a lot of the bigger companies, they're global in nature. I feel like they're looking for talent all over the place, and they're not trying to constrain themselves to one geographic area. So, I really thought it was going to be in the 90s. It'd be interesting to hear a version 1, like how they define distributed in their survey.
That's a good point. Andrew?
Yeah, it's a weird mix. I almost look at it as, offshore, onshore almost, where distributed sort of carries that context where your teams are either onshore or offshore, and almost sort of the cultural aspect that offshore produces, and maybe this is just my perception. Well, this definitely is just my perception of the companies that I've worked in is, offshore tends to get the work that no one else wants to do.
So Ryan, your quote, I don't know if that's an original, because it is, if it, where you said that if at least one person on the team is virtual, that whole team is virtual. That's, I think, a great observation. Where I currently am, 100% of our teams are virtual. There is not one fully co-located team in the entire org, as far as I've seen, in my entire vertical, which does present its own challenges. But at least one, if not multiple members of the team, either work onshore, distributed via home full-time, near shore, or they're even remote across the pond in the subcontinent. So it's Jason's question about how do they define distributed teams is, I think, very pertinent. Maybe they can add some detail going forward for that. But I think that is a – it seems to be not the exception. It's more of the rule nowadays. All right, moving along. next thing I wanted to talk about, if you scroll down to page 7, there's a question of what is the percentage of teams inside your organization actually utilizing an Agile methodology? And it seems that the biggest response was 58% of the organization surveyed have less than half of their teams using Agile. So I was looking for some thoughts, observations on why that may be the case. Andrew, I'm going to start with you.
Oh, man. Always starting with me. I guess when we say using Agile, I guess, you know, how is that being defined? Is it what framework they're using? Are they being Agile in sort of their thinking? Are they delivering in an, you know, iterative fashion? That question sort of is that's a tough one for me to sort of sum up and answer.
Yeah, I think, Andrew, I mean, another point to that is, like, what are they, are they just talking about software teams?
Yeah.
You know, is it that the technology teams are all using some form of Agile for delivery, but they have a ton of operations teams that aren't? So they're saying that only half of our org is Agile and the other half isn't? I mean, there was some ambiguity from my perspective, too, along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, if I have to sit in another finance review board or some type of investment review board meeting, I can promise you most of those fine folks and professionals that I work with in that space do not really have a lean or agile mindset. But I think, assuming that we're talking about the folks in charge of delivery, be that software, be that physical product, just be that idea delivery, do you guys think that 58% is indicative of what you're seeing in industry? Or is that, where does that fall within your comfort zone if we're just talking about the delivery teams?
I mean, to me, that sounds like a company that's, I wouldn't say, if I'm looking at 4 years of high school, right, I wouldn't say they're freshmen, they're more along on the sophomore page of their journey, because usually the early adopting teams all spin up very quickly. Then you have your other teams that watch the prior predecessors figure it out and say, okay, that's how I'm going to do it. But once you get to junior and senior year, that's where you have, I would say, 70 or 80% adoption, where even the teams that didn't really see at the beginning how they fit in the Agile world start adopting the practice because they're starting to sort of see where they fit in that context.
And I guess I would sort of, again, I think that number just, I don't know, it doesn't resonate well with me, just because, you know, maturity, or is this a binary response? Are we Agile? Yes or no? Click yes, click no. Sort of, you know, what is that definition? So how are we defining how the team is actually maturing? And, you know, you could have a team or an organization that's been what they deem doing Agile for years, and they could be extremely immature in that practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it kind of comes down, like, when we spoke to, I want to say it was Martin Fowler, he talked to the fact that there's project managers in ThoughtWorks that are way more Agile than most Scrum Masters that exist. And I think the easy, lazy answer as to how do you define Agile is, are they following one of the generally accepted Agile frameworks? But I think it, you know, after going through that major project that we did with the Manifesto authors, it's more of a mindset. Are we looking to embrace the four value statements and most of the 12 principles in how we deliver the software or deliver the product? So when I look at the number, that's usually the centering point that I'm looking for. You know, are we sticking with the plan regardless of the reality that's around us? Are we focusing more on the documentation than the working software? Do contracts take a precedence over the actual working with people in collaboration. So anyways, that's my soapbox.
No, I guess. So your perception of that question, when they say using Agile, it's more of adoption and utilization of the mindset as opposed to a particular framework, process, or methodology.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. I think, Ryan, this is going to be a hot button topic for you because software development quality is always one of the things that gets you aroused. On page 8, there's a question of what are the reasons for adopting Agile and what are the benefits of adopting Agile? Now, the top 3 in the survey are accelerate project delivery is number 1, enhance ability to manage changing priorities is number 2, and increase productivity is number 3. Each one of those polled at over 50%. High watermark was 69. Way down at number 5 was enhanced software quality. And if you look at it, there's a subsequent page which talks about perceived Agile benefits. Software quality, again, is 7th. Now, I wanted to butt this up against Jason Little of Lean Change Management did a decade of Agile where he basically summarized these surveys and compared them against one another. And in his decade of Agile, it shows that collective code ownership, refactoring, things like that are decreasing in importance. So what does this portend for the future of Agile? Is the emphasis becoming more on process and not on actual making development safer developers and quality? What are you guys' thoughts on that? I'm going to start with Jason Cusack.
That's a great question, Harshko. Part of it, I wonder if it's generational, right? So there's two aspects that jump out to me. One is the generational, right? Are the new software developers that are taking on this craft, do they take it with the same seriousness that maybe a different generation may have approached that craft with? So that's one question that jumps out to me.
I think it's an interesting question as well. Just along the fact that, I think we're actually maybe not increasing quality, but we're changing the conversation of how development's done. So I think the development arm is engaged at a different level now. So you might be exposing the lack of quality faster because you are communicating or supposedly communicating more efficiently and in real time, as opposed to, just reading off of a tech spec and then coding it and then putting something out there and then literally saying, well, this isn't what we wanted at all. So you're getting more people involved in the creation of that, not just developers.
So, Jay, when you started with this question, you served me up, and I'm not going to disappoint. So there is a common conception, and it's almost classifiable as a misconception, that adopting Agile practices means that you are going to accelerate product delivery. And 69% of the respondents said that's a reason for Agile adoption. Agile does not make lines of code magically produce themselves faster in an IDE and get released into production quicker. You're going to reasonably have the same amount of cognitive output from software engineers and professionals that you would have had in any other framework. What Agile allows you to do is to write higher quality code more meaningfully in a high value format. So you're no longer focusing on just writing software because the plan says it, or focusing on meeting a contract. What you're laser focused in on is delivering high quality software that produces real value for real people and throwing away all of the other waste. So yes, you do accelerate product delivery, but from a from a balance sheet perspective or from a number cruncher perspective or from the perspective of anybody that's never really worked with a software team, it means something different than just creating more code, because creating more code is often not going to produce more value. Finding meaningful software that actually creates value in a responsible fashion that actually contributes to a more stable product base for users to extract value from is what Agile truly is about. And quite often we just think, hey, if we bring in Scrum, we're going to get more features out. And my God, if that is just the thing that drives me crazy. Finding the core of what clean code, what scalable architecture, what collective code ownerships, all of the aspects of extreme programming and some of the emerging things like mob programming and just, you know, all of these core things, writing unit tests, starting with test-driven development, all of these things that are pretty much now lost because we're focused so hard on certified scrum masters, certified product owners, all of the things that actually are the core of agile software development are what actually allow you to create, to accelerate that product delivery and find value faster.
So, good point. Let me ask you this. I've something just occurred to me. So nowadays when companies adopt Agile, in my current engagement, when they talk about adopting Agile, they're not talking about adopting SAFe. They're not talking about doing Scrum. They're talking about using an Agile methodology and a framework along with DevOps processes. Now, I know DevOps is a term that's been beaten to death, but they're now considered part and parcel based upon the conversations I have. If you're doing Agile, you're doing continuous integration, continuous deployment, test-driven development, unit testing, whatever. Is it possible that reason why software quality and ranks lower in some of these surveys is it's not thought of because it's assumed that it's a given with adopting good DevOps? Or, and maybe people are just forgetting about it? Or is it really the emphasis being placed on the whole quicker, faster, cheaper, not necessarily a better quality?
So let's take a small step back, right? Like most of the organizations, and we'll get back into the state of Agile report in a minute, I'm sure. But most of the organizations that are looking to either improve quality or they're looking to accelerate, let's be honest, what are they dealing with? They're dealing with typically a software product that has a high degree of legacy code. And just for a quick definition of legacy code, if you look at Michael Feathers, who is the, you know, the godfather of what legacy code is, he says it's any code without a test. If you look to some of the emerging thought leaders, what legacy code is, it's code without confidence. But either way, you have code that you don't have a high degree of confidence in. Anytime you start from a point where you have code that you do not have a high degree of confidence in, and you're not looking at your deployment process in the structure of DevOps and starting from a way that we can deploy things on a regular, sustainable, high-quality basis, which is always going to center around good software practices and an intent focus on creating a DevOps build chain and a DevOps deployment process and a continuous integration cycle, then you're setting yourself up for failure. All you're going to do is create more legacy code without high standards and, you know, soft environmental parity issues and all of the things that kind of befall legacy code systems.
Jason, Andrew, any thoughts? I'll take that as a no. I think Ryan and I lost everybody going down the DevOps nerd rabbit hole.
I think that some of this is lost in sort of what the goal is. If the goal is to improve software quality, what's being done to do that? And is the team courageous in trying to figure out how to self-manage to do that? And will the organization support any level of disruption to allow the team to do that? So I think that there's a little bit of a silver bullet mentality when, you know, you sort of brand it as, oh, we're going to go agile, that all these things are going to happen. But what are you truly doing to do agile daily and not just do agile in a day? So I think that to me, it's sort of, again, these surveys, I don't know, they just, to me, they don't paint the real picture. There's too much ambiguity in them.
Yeah, they serve for a good framework to have a podcast conversation.
Hey.
Good point. So the next topic I wanted to touch on is agile methodologies. And methodologies currently being used. Right now, Scrum is by far and away the largest. It's at 58% of the survey respondents, adding an additional 10% for some sort of Scrum and XP hybrid. So I wanted to get some thoughts on that. And then I also want to discuss some of the other less adopted methodologies, what you guys' thoughts are on those, what your exposure is, and do they have a chance, or is it going to be Scrum all day now and forever? Scrum Uber Owls. Mr. Cusack, I want to start with you.
Well, yeah, I mean, Scrum is king, right? I mean, there's, especially, even if you look at, like, some of those older ones, I mean, XP, is that, you know, less than 1%? I mean, you have to wonder, who are the people that are taking this? Is this, like, a group of project managers that are filling this out? Is this really a group of people on a team that are filling it out? You know, I feel like Scrum is the most accessible to folks in the form of, like, a keyword. Like you could go into any organization and say, hey, we're doing Scrum, and someone would go, oh yeah, it's the thing that they do in rugby, and they kind of do it at our company too, right? So, you know, I don't think it's any shocker that is at 58%. I think what is interesting though is that you have all these other ones, like XP being less than 1%. DSDM is kind of old, but XP is the big shocker to me. And especially when you're talking about all the, if the reason to do this is to accelerate product development, why is lean startup less than 1%? Like that's just crazy to me.
So I think, Jason, what is the famous Scrum Alliance saying, that Scrum is easy to understand, difficult to master, or something like that, right? There is something to that, right? That Scrum is pretty simple. When you talk about the number of roles there are to be played and the number of actual ceremonies there are to actually adhere to. But most high-performing teams that I'm working with, or that I've had the luxury of working with in the past, usually start off with something like Scrum or Kanban, and then they rapidly do a hybrid. But when you speak with them, they still say, hey, we're a Scrum team. I think one thing that, you know, kind of grinds my gears is when we say that XP is less than 1%, any high-performing software team is employing XP practices into their either Scrum framework, their Safe framework, their Kanban framework, or whatever the heck it is that they're labeling themselves as. But XP as a framework, I think, is not even understood, let alone a highly practiced. So that less than 1% kind of resonates with me. But things like pair programming, test-driven development, collective code ownership, all of the actual practices that made up the XP framework, most high-performing software teams are actually still employing them into the container framework that they operate under.
Andrew, thoughts?
Yeah, I feel like I just keep saying the same thing in different ways.
Andrew, what do you think 5% other is? Under the agile methods and practices.
Yeah, I mean, 5% other is, I think it's a higher number. I don't think many organizations do Scrum well. I think they tailor it to what they need it to do, or what they think they need it to do, unless the value or even following the principles. I mean, Scrum isn't a checklist. Do we abide by the values? Do we really define and sort of deliver value? Do we honor our commitments as a team? Is the team building that within sort of that Scrum fashion? I haven't seen that done well in the 6-7 organizations I've been in.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. So Andrew, you're thinking 58% Scrum. That's probably not all pure great Scrum. There's probably some Scrum butt in there, or some Scrum and, or some Scrum to fall, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's anything that's pure Scrum, right? I don't even know if that exists. That just might be, utopia. But I think the thinking and if you can, at least understand the principles and understand why you're doing it this way, as opposed to, like our podcast about being inflicted or invited. Literally, it's just around, am I being told to do this? And I don't have any stock in it. I don't think it's the right way, or I don't agree with it. And I just have to do it because that's what my manager is telling me. Do we continue with the command and control, or are we truly allowing the innovation to happen to deliver a quality product?
So I'm confused. Isn't Scrum where you just send somebody off to get Scrum Master certified? You install Jira, and then you measure everything in story points instead of hours?
That's what I thought it was.
Oh, all right, cool. All right, we're on the same page.
All right. So we all meet that quality. Moving along. Next thing I wanted to talk about was, there's a question buried in the bottom. Again, this is one of those weird ones. I'm surprised they buried it. Agile in outsourced development projects. 51% of the respondents said they are using agile practices to manage outsourced development projects. So I wanted to see what everyone's experience was, what their thoughts are. Is this a good idea? Is this a recipe for disaster? I'm going to let Ryan go first.
So for context, I'm a full-time employee at an organization I do have some outsourced staff aug models in place. I'm not a consultant. I believe in high functioning teams forming around a core base of team members, and outsourcing generally means you bring somebody in on a temporary basis to deliver a project. They roll off the project, and there's either a gap in the organization, or the project is put into a run the engine, or just to keep the lights on type maintenance mode. So in my opinion, I'm not a huge fan of the outsourcing in agile projects, especially if you're looking at it through the project lens of, yes, we have this idea that we want to deliver and we see it as core, a project, then maybe, yeah, sure. Go do some staff aug, or go do some, go with that model. But if you're looking to create a product, something that's sustainable, something that is no longer bound by the start date and the end date, then I think a well-formed team that has deep and rich context and a deep and rich understanding of each other and how we're looking, and a core set of values by which they're looking to deliver the product, you know, having a more permanent footprint or placehold on team members is a little bit more valuable. Given my unique perspective.
So it's interesting you say that, Ryan, because I just was talking to somebody who was working with an agile release train, right? And the tenure on the train for people was 35 years of experience with the same company. And through that, they had delivered. And when you ask them, when have they actually delivered software into production? It was twice. So I'm not sure that having, you know, that, whether it's that FTE staff aug sort of mentality, I think culturally that an organization can sort of set that precedence that a contractor doesn't have as much invested in delivering a quality product because they're not technically full time with the organization as opposed to an FTE. I'm not sure I believe that. So I think you'll find whether you're, however you're branded as an employee of the organization, whether it's full-time or not, it depends on the person, and it depends on how the organization supports those individuals.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, my position isn't that anyone cares more or less about quality. Mine is more or less an organizational stance of how are we looking to maintain this idea. We're looking to staff it as a project or a product. And if we're going to do one versus the other, especially if we're looking at creating something with, we're trying to elongate that growth curve as long as possible, then I'm looking probably to something that's a little bit more leaning towards the FTE model. But that doesn't mean that contractors are not caring about quality, or that they're just in there to make the dollar and get out. We all know that there's plenty of times that contractors are the lifeblood of a product. There's always going to be that contingent to consider when you talk about staffing models.
Okay. Yeah, because I didn't even like when you were talking about that, and as I was listening to Ryan and Andrew, I wasn't even thinking of like a staff aug perspective. I was thinking of, I need like a customer relationship management tool. I need a CRM. I'm going to outsource that and buy it from someone and potentially inflict my agile process on them. That's kind of how I interpreted that. Am I way off base?
No, I think you're pretty much on it.
Because to me, there's a huge difference between a staff aug, like having a set of contractors that might not be long-term, or a group of people that you're doing a test drive with, versus an entirely other entity or organization or company that you are trying to integrate into your delivery mechanism, right? Like those two concepts are completely different. So if you look at the staff aug model, I mean, if that's really what that means, I mean, I just don't really see the relevancy in that, because there's a shit ton of companies that are always going to do that forever, right? Because it's just how companies work today.
No, it's actually a really valid point, and given the perspective that you just laid out, I think if you're looking at it from the through the lens of how are we looking to build that next CRM or CMS or whatever the hell your next build out is, through that lens, that is a positive metric. We're looking to partner with outsourcing vendors that are going to be delivering us our product in a leaner and agile fashion. That's a positive trend. And that's one that I think makes a lot more sense in industry. So yeah, I mean, context matters, right?
Well, I was thinking too, Ryan, that from an RFP perspective, if I am talking to two different vendors and one of them says that they're able to do agile with some form of competency and the other one says that they can't, I'm going with the group that says that they can't. Right. So to me, that's also like a differentiator to these vendors that are vying for business.
Well, let's even take the label agile out of the conversation. If I'm going to work with a vendor, like let's just put our pretend CTO cap on, our COO, CEO, whatever level we want to pretend we are right now. If I go to a company and say, hey, I want this software thing, and they come back and say, okay, we can build this for you, and every 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 1 month, whatever the cadence is going to be, if we're going with an iterative delivery process or something based on sprints or increments, and you're going to show me working software every single time box, okay, that builds instant trust, that builds instant value return and a feedback loop that is just doesn't exist in a waterfall fashion. So I think taking away the label agile makes it, and looking at it through the lens of, hey, I can actually see working software in a regular cadence, makes it way more understandable for the non-technical, non-agile practitioner perspective.
Yeah, but if you're delivering often, let's just say, but is it more valuable that you're delivering more often? Because are you actually delivering what the customer wants?
So I think the answer to that is that's up to the customer to decide. If you're delivering often and you're off base, I'd rather find out 2 weeks in than 2, 3, 4 months, right?
No, we're in violent agreement with that. I just, defining what that value is, isn't always necessarily done.
In an RFP perspective, there's a I'm going to use your term, there's a violent attempt to define what value is.
Well, and so I'll say this is a potential closure remark on the topic. I think that 10 years ago, if you were talking to vendors about Agile, there is no one doing that. And I think that has changed. I think that now that this is, you know, more pervasive within our industry and that you have more cross-pollination with people moving job to job, and you have this sense of we need to be competitive in our market and we need to be able to deliver a little more nimbly. I think that from my perspective, even being at some of these larger enterprises, I've seen actually some of these vendors do Agile better than the home company, right, who's got a group of coaches. So I think it's an interesting dynamic there, and it's something that we should certainly keep an eye on, because that is, at least from my experience, vastly different than the way it used to be.
Agreed.
And that was a perfect topper in that conversation. Thank you, Jason. Next topic we were going to cover off is at the page 12 mark of the report. It talks about the challenges experienced adopting and scaling Agile. And it does call out here that respondents were able to make multiple selections, so that will throw off your percentages somewhat. The top two or three were company philosophy or culture at odds with core Agile values. Number two was lack of experience with Agile methods. And number three was lack of management support. Right behind that, almost within a hair's breadth, was general organizational resistance to change. And then the rounding out the top five was lack of business, customer, product owner. Does this jibe with what you guys are seeing? And I know we've all been involved in transformations and adoptions, transmogrifications. And I know some of us have had some especially hairy ones. So does this match up to what we see on a day-to-day basis? Jason, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah. I mean, when I look at, you know, 1, 3, and 4, I kind of couch that as my topic of people are assholes. Hmm. I mean, I can't tell you how many times it's, you know, people are just resistant to change. They don't want to have to work hard. And that might seem like it's a characterization or something that I'm just kind of pulling out my ass, and it's totally not. Like, every place I've been, there has been this huge resistance to, well, what does it mean for me as a manager? What does it mean for my team? I'm losing my fiefdom. I'm not going to have all these people underneath my control. I don't have my minions to do my bidding. I think that is a real, and what's really interesting is that when we were talking about one of the other graphics, Arsco, there was something about culture change, and that was like at the very bottom for reasons why we're doing this. Yet that is the one reason on at least this page that it's difficult to adopt. So to me, there's a disconnect between what the true value of this is. And I think that people are looking at these agile teams as just kind of meat grinder teams. Like, you know, we don't really care about sustainable pace. We just want you to get it done and figure out a way. You're agile now, so it should be easier. Do more with less. Have at it. Right. And I don't necessarily think that is, the reality of what it should be. None of the categories there surprise me. But it's interesting that it's really focused on people. It's focused on culture change. It's focused on management support. And even along the lines of management support, what does that mean, right? Is that like senior leaders? Is that middle management? Are we talking about, is it, because I was thinking of like the diamond aspect where you have like this heavy group of middle managers. Are they the ones freaking out? How hierarchical is your organization? Do you have, managers reporting to senior managers, reporting to directors, reporting to senior directors, reporting to VPs, so on and so forth, right? I mean, I feel like a lot of companies are even real top heavy on the management side. So obviously, if the goal of some of these transformations is to bring transparency about that stuff and work more efficiently, you're going to have people fight it.
Go ahead, Ryan.
So I'm going to take your point of, people are assholes, which it's hard to argue, but I'm actually going to try to go over the top and say, while that is the case in some scenarios, I think what is more largely the case is that organizations are dog shit at communicating change and creating a sense of safety and creating a sense of purpose. If I'm going to go Daniel Pink on you, I'll go purpose, autonomy and mastery within the context of a change, which agile adoption is a change in the way that we do things. So, yeah, I mean, you're going to have your change resistors, you're going to have your change promoters, and you're going to have your happy middles. But if you're not able to clearly communicate the intent of the change and what better looks like and how this is going to affect the people and create an environment which the people can continue to be successful in a changing ecosystem, then you're just breeding contempt. And I think organizations say they want to be disruptive. They want to say that they're being innovative. They want to use all of these buzzwords that are really big out there. But they continue to harbor these practices and these organizational constraints that fly at odds with the values that they're trying to promote. If we just get better as organizations at creating environments that embrace change, embrace learning, and embrace safety, then a lot of these top items in this chart start diminishing. Will they ever go away? Probably not. But we can have a positive impact on the change resistance that is seen during agile transformation.
To me, I think the fact that general organizational resistance to change was the fourth highest ranking response, and I think that's probably a throwaway, and I would toss that, because what organization responds to change well? I mean, human beings, we know the whole Kubler-Ross 5 stages of grief, right? The change curve that people work through, that's a given. So I don't even think that should be on there as a response. I also don't even agree with the, there was another one here that said, pervasiveness of traditional development. Why? I hate to be obscene, but no shit, right? The whole reason you're going agile is because your traditional development is not as beneficial as you hoped it would be. I would actually wipe that one off the board. Company philosophy, culture at odds with core agile values. My experience has been that is a big problem. The culture change is probably the hardest nut to crack, but the lack of management support, inefficient middle management. I think those are some of the biggest things that I've seen have been the biggest challenges when it comes to agile adoption. Because like you said, Jason, everybody's first question is what's in it for me? And where do I fit in this new world? And middle management, especially if I'm looking at the safe big picture, there is no middle management head. And I think that makes a lot of people nervous. Andrew, what are your thoughts?
No, and I think, you know, organizational change is sort of it's a big topic. So how do you attack it? How do you even start to broach the conversation without just saying, oh, we need to, you know, change as an organization? Well, you should always be looking to change as an organization to whether that's improve or whatever that may look like, but where do you start? So whether it's, you know, to me, it's got to start at some leadership focus. Someone has to me, the top person, CEO, whatever that person is in a company, has to own that change and has to make that their initiative to support and sort of drive the organization towards what they are defining as the goal for change. So fear is huge. How do you overcome that fear? And how do you break that component of saying, I'm afraid to lose my job. So if I do this, I could lose my job or get in trouble. But yet most people probably never even take that risk because they just don't know. It's sort of like when you're a little kid, you do something and you get yelled at by your parents, but have your parents ever done anything that horrible to you that you know, sways you from doing things? No, you just have this innate fear that you're going to get in trouble. It's in, like you said, Hersko, it's sort of like, it's just that fear component of getting in trouble and sort of, how do you break that? So to me, I always like to just sort of frame it up, and this isn't to, you know, be safe centric or whatever, but Cotter really, to me, just frames it up really well is, you know, you create that vision, you start to show short-term wins, you start to build that trust in the organization and literally create that coalition feel where you're guiding or you're sort of uniting as a group. So it's just not a silver bullet strategy. There's just not one way to do it. The organization has to figure out how they want to break those patterns. It's, you know, it's all ingrained in us as since we were born. I mean, it's human nature. How do you change the human psyche?
So two quick thoughts. First, I don't know that the Cotter change model belongs to SAFE. I think it existed before. So
it does, but it's referenced in SAFE a lot. So
okay. Just got to take that away from you real quick.
Got to twist the knife.
Leffingwell does not own that. So the other thing I was going to say is that, you know, Jay, I don't want to just sound like I'm picking fights, even though that's probably what I sound like. The idea that people and humans don't like change is again, I think that's a misnomer. What people hate and what people resist is misguided change. If you just come in and start telling people that their world is going to be turned upside down, yeah, you're going to run into some issues there. But if you start guiding somebody through a change progression and you start telling them what better looks like and how you're going to assist them to get there, I mean, if we can go all lean change management and start talking about the options and the experiments and the collective learning, it's a much easier path. And, you know, you look into some of the learning from Simon Sinek, and if you tell people why we're going to make this change, they're much more likely to adopt to it and not have that initial animalistic resistance to the change.
So if I'm going to sum up your statement is, people are not resistant to change. They're resistant to poorly communicated change, non-transparent change where they can't see the why coming behind it. That's what really gets people reluctant to adopt.
I think that's a big indicator. I mean, there's no silver bullet here, but if you can't define the intent of the change and how the change is going to have some positive influence on the person, then yeah, you're going up against a losing battle.
But also though, I sort of agree, but don't fully agree, because we've in corporate culture, we've sort of, you know, not sort of, it's moved away from the human aspect of it. You know, we don't care about people, we care about work.
Yeah.
So when do we start caring about people? And when you start caring about people, people start to invest in the culture and driving change.
Yeah, I think that goes full circle to where I think my little piece started here. The by and large, and I'm fine painting with the broad brush here, most organizations suck at that. I mean, the shepherding change through an organization is not easy. You have to start focusing on the things that we generally overlook, the neuroscience, the anthropological aspects of organizations, and you have to actually have a strong investment in human capital and understanding what that means. It's not just cranking out features. I mean, you need strong leaders, you need human-centered leaders, and you need folks that are scoped in on the right thing. They're not just trying to extend their contract by another 3 years, but from the board to keep themselves in a golden parachute situation. So here's how you're going to see it. Andrew and anybody that cares, you're going to see that number, those top four or five things and why organizations resist agile transformations continue to grow. That is a sad indicator of how bad we are at manifesting and shepherding change in large organizations.
Yeah, I still see it as a management issue, man. I see it as there's a difference between management and leadership. And I mean, I've seen teams that are flourished. Like, you take the parameters off of them, you're like, you know, you guys can do what you need to do to make your life more effective. They take to that. And they get beaten down by the managers who are like, I need my status report. I need this other thing. Why didn't you do this other thing for me? I really feel like the gating factor for these people is this leadership level or the lack of leadership. Because I think the teams are capable of changing. I think they want to do that because they have more ownership over it instead of being dictated to. But it's the dictators that have to be removed from that situation. And organizationally, companies are very uncomfortable saying, hey, you know what? We're taking these people that used to have these big orgs and we're just going to say that they don't have them anymore. It's just not happening. I think there's a huge miss between what we want our teams to do versus how we manage them in the hierarchy.
And totally agree with what Cusack said. And also the other component is financial, right? How do you budget the human aspect of things? You don't. You can't plan your 3-year to 5-year budget based on, you know, the happiness factor. There's ways to do it, but no one's focusing on that because it's too hard to show ROI in my opinion, in their mind. So, you know, the financial component has to change as well. You know, when do we stop budgeting projects and start funding teams?
Perfect. Perfect. I am going to skip us ahead. Nobody minds. We did some good diving on the topic. Next is everybody's favorite, scaling. So one part of the report deals with scaling methods and approaches. And for the first time, SAFe has overtaken Scrum/Scrums with 28% as opposed to 27%. Right behind that is internally created methods at 13%. And then it goes through the poo-poo platter. So lean management, agile portfolio management, less dad rage, which I honestly, admittance of ignorance, I never heard of until I read this thing. And then Nexus. So what are you guys' thoughts on that? Why is SAFe slowly and steadily becoming the big dog? And do the other scaling methodologies, do they even have a chance? Let's start with Andrew.
So the whole scaling thing is just out of hand. I mean, again, I think we've just rebranded Agile as a, you know, now we're calling it SAFe. So SAFe is now the new flavor of the month or whatever, you know, but even when you start to scale, are you truly scaling because you've sort of reached the limit or you want to expand your practice and continue to optimize at a larger scale? Or are you just saying, well, we have too many people now, we need to start scaling this, and SAFe is the first thing that comes up in my Google search, or that's what the consulting company that I hired to tell me to do is doing. So, I, a lot of the times, you know, I'm on a huge SAFe implementation now, and they're not practicing good Scrum, period. They're not doing Scrum well, so they're not scaling well. So again, it's defining what that means to the organization. Why are you scaling? What's the benefit of you doing this other than you think it's the right thing to do, or you were told it's the right thing to do? So, I haven't heard of, you know, a lot of the other frameworks either. I mean, it seems like SAFe is the front runner because that's the most popular at the moment.
Jason, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think I wonder how much of that's a political play. Because if I took Scrum at 27% and combined it with large scale Scrum at 3%, I get Scrum and less at the top, right? Scrum being my foundation with less being my scaling framework. I kind of see those two things a little bit hand in hand, part and parcel to some degree. And I really think, if you ask me why is Safe taking over, it's because they have a great marketing strategy. They've done, their website is nice. It speaks to executives well, because it talks about alignment, it talks about visibility, it talks about transparency and decision making. And I think that a lot of the scaling frameworks are attempting to do that in principle. But I think that Safe just did it better on the execution side of their website. And nothing against Ambler and Mark Lyons, but if you look at the website for DAD, Discipline Agile Delivery, right, it's garbage. Like, it just looks like shit. So, you know, unless you have an in with Ambler and he's coming to talk to you about, you know, whatever, you know, architectural practices that, you know, emergent design or whatever the things that he's touting, you know, but you go to his website because you've never interacted with the guy and you see that versus Safe, you're probably going to pick Safe. So I wonder how much of this isn't marketing driven. I'm neutral on it. I'm not a Safe bot. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh my God, Safe's amazing. I'm also not Mike Beadle, right? I'm also not going to shit all over Safe just for the sake of shitting on it. So, I guess in my mind, there's elements of that work. And I think it's really just a great marketing plan by Laughing Well. Slow clap for him.
Not to cut you off, Andrew, I would actually sort of agree with this in the sense that when you think about selling the idea of scaling or adopting Agile, it always comes part and parcel with, well, how are we going to do it? And the next question that comes along is, well, what method are we going to use? What framework are we going to use? Like you said, there's a nice, pretty, safe, big picture on that website. You have two tools in version one and Rally that were built purposefully to support the scaled Agile framework. So when I think about that and I want to sell my framework to somebody else, I say, look, I've got a framework. I've got everybody's roles defined, and I got this tool that goes along with it. So you're going to use my framework. You're going to buy this tool. Everything's going to make sense. It's all going to jive together. There's not that mental gymnastics that comes with, okay, if I'm going to use this framework, what tools do I use? Because tools is always a big question. We're going to get to that later in the agenda. But that's always a big question. Well, how do I track this stuff? How do I generate metrics around this stuff? And the fact that you have a tool that matches perfectly to your framework that has a nice, big, pretty picture, and everybody knows that when you reach a certain tier in the layer cake that is technology management, the oxygen gets less and less and less, and pictures and Duplo blocks get to be the greatest thing in the world. The fact that I can show the big picture of somebody and say, hey, this is what we're going to use. I think you're absolutely right. I think it just comes down to good marketing. And I do like some of the ideas when I've investigated some of the other frameworks. I've looked at Less, I've looked at Data, in Nexus, and I found some, which oddly isn't even on here. I found some things I do like, but I think you're right. I think they have the best marketing. Sort of like a VHS or beta argument. Ryan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm not selling frameworks. I'm not selling scaling tools. I'm selling quality working software. So I'll just abstain from the conversation.
So one quick add to that, I think, you know, again, sort of Safe offers the solution that they're offering. There's a lot of IP that goes along with it as well. So there's a lot of material that you get when you sort of adopt that scaling framework. So you have a lot of information that you can put out to an organization, and you have a central point to go back to reference. So they do offer a lot of information. And again, I'm not sitting here I don't think that Safe is the answer to everything, but from a packaging standpoint, and just like you guys were saying, from a marketing standpoint, they have almost a complete package where, you know, you do adopt and then you get a lot of information that you can utilize for your organization.
Millie Vanilli won an Emmy.
Oh, Jesus. And with the Millie Vanilli reference showing you how old we all are, I'm going to finish up with the last question. And the last question was about tools. And if you skip to the end, obviously this, let's be honest here, there is implicit bias. This report is authored by a tool company, for lack of a better term. So the use of Agile management tools,
believe it or not, and I think a lot of us believe it, Atlassian / Jira is the top at 53%, with Excel right on its tails at 46%.
I can't believe that many people are still using Excel, for Christ's sakes.
Well, let's talk about that, right? So after Jira and Excel, it pretty much drops off to everybody sitting in the lower tranches. You have TFS, Project, Version 1, Google Docs, Rally, which is now CA Agile, ALM.
A whiteboard doesn't even make the list. Everybody's got to use a tool. So, like, you know, just a white wall with some cards, that's not even... Well,
there is no tools at all, which I guess would be your whiteboard, or that would be in-house / homegrown at 10%. Other shows up as 14. I'd be real curious to see what the other is. What are you guys' thoughts on why Jira still remains top of the heap? My honest opinion is it's easy to stand up. It's easy to instantiate. It's fairly inexpensive. And the UI is nothing to write home about, but it does work. That's my thoughts. And Excel, if I'm going to start out and not use a tool and just try and feel my way through adopting Agile, Excel does make sense because I'm not owned to software. Ryan, thoughts?
So as a director of a team that uses Jira, I guess I got to chime in here. So first of all, Jira is a nice play for the enterprise, right? You can sell a tool that satisfies multiple teams, that is, to your point, Jay, very easy to stand up. It's highly customizable, highly flexible. It's basically the WordPress of Agile software, and it does everything to some variable degree of good. It has its constraints, it has its issues, but if you're willing to get into the configuration aspects, you can pretty much make Jira do damn near anything you want it to do. And what you can't make it do, you can go to the add-in marketplace, and sure enough, someone is there to sell you a ware to solve all your ills. One thing that I kind of wish I did now that we're talking is overlay. So there's a section in the version one report that talks about how many years experience does your company have with Agile. And I'm curious to see if that number is actually starting to trend forward. You would like to think it is, because of it's the 11th annual State of Agile report, so we should be moving the tide forward. But I'm wondering if there's an interesting metric, and I'm actually going to volunteer to do this and post it in the show notes or link to it, with if the use of Excel is decreasing at a proportional rate to the overall annual level of experience that folks have with Agile, meaning the more experience we have, the lower the use of Excel is. Because as far as tracking tools go, I've never used Excel as an Agile tracking tool. I can't imagine it's a very effective.
Dude, I'm telling you right now, I hate Jira. Absolutely hate it. Can't stand it. I would rather use fucking Word, to be honest with you, to manage my backlog than ever use Jira. That's just and I probably have a bias against it. To me, I totally get why people use Excel, because it's available. It comes with every enterprise suite that you have as a corporation. I can open it right now and I can start putting shit in there and create my backlog instantly.
Jay,
I don't need to debate all the structure of things or create workflow. I don't have to do any of those things that I'm required to do in Jira. So to me, there and really any of those tools, there's a barrier to entry for the novice.
How do you feel about Jira, though?
I fucking hate Jira, dude.
Yeah, I'm with Cusack on that one. And I don't think Jira is a good Agile tool at all.
No, it's terrible. Issues. Can't you fucking change it to something other than the name Issues? Can't be a story? Sorry, ran over. I just hate it.
Yeah, and it does not do portfolio well. It does not burn up to sort of... It just doesn't feel Agile when you really start to work in it. And to me, I think it's extremely difficult to roll out. I think you sort of bastardize it, because organizations have pockets running Jira. So they're like, oh, well, we already have this in-house. Now we're going to use it as our ALM tool. But
I will say this. I'm on the fence when it regards to Jira. I've seen really shitty implementations of it, that we were better off using fucking wampum and smoke signals. I have seen some iterations where it's tightly coupled to Confluence. And if you tie Jira to Confluence, you can actually probably, it was a pretty mature utilization of Jira. I actually liked it. I liked how the team was using it. I liked how the group was using it, because it tied everything together. But I think you're right. The issues thing does sort of kill it. But I don't know. I think whatever works. I have used Excel to track an agile delivery as an agile delivery tool, and it, you know, Excel, I always joke, is one of the, is probably the most universal business critical application in all of enterprise IT, because everybody does shit in Excel that they probably shouldn't, with pivot tables and all this sort of stuff. But it does work. It's just, it's not the greatest thing in the world. I can see why version one and Rally are further down the list, because let's be honest with you, they're cost prohibitive. I know version one is rather pricey. I know Rally is just up there. I think version one, I'm working with a vendor who uses version one, and internally my engagement uses Rally, so I get to see both simultaneously. And I think version one has a little bit better lipstick on that pig. I think it has a nicer UI. It's a little bit easier, a little bit more navigable, but maybe that's just me.
And so sort of the, you know, going on the Jira tirade, it literally, I've had to use Excel to manage Jira, because I can't get what I need out of Jira. So I'm one of those that has to create all those freaking pivot tables and, you know, provide those, that level of optics that you can't get out of Jira. I mean, hell, if you're trying to do freaking burn downs or even just look at hours, it's, everything's in seconds. I mean, when you export out of Jira, it's all in seconds. Like, it's ridiculous. Hate it.
So yeah, I think, sorry. I was going to say, the last comment I'll make about Jira is, I think for like a brand new team, small organization, not a lot of moving parts, hyper-focus on technical practices and DevOps, Jira's the best. It's great. It solves all those needs. Big organization trying to scale, lots of legacy applications, lots of different moving pieces, lots of different iterations you're trying to report on, Jira's the worst.
So let me just try to find some happy middle ground here. By no means am I saying Jira is the greatest thing that's ever happened to Agile. What I do want to say is this. Any organization that tries to govern the workflow or the configuration or the way that these ALM tools interface with teams and teams interface with the tools, such that teams have to abide by the structure and the parameters of the tool, is not only doing a giant disservice, but they're actually creating, I don't use anti-patterns often, but they're actually creating an organizational anti-pattern. The tool should not govern the work. It should not govern the team. The team should govern the tool, and if not, then the tool's ineffective. Thoughts?
Nice. And that is a perfect way to wrap up this podcast, because I think
Hold on, Hersko. We got one more thing we got to talk about.
Okay.
And dude, this is like the worst fucking stat on the entire report. I'm going to go to page 13. It's how success is measured with Agile projects.
Okay.
And the number one answer there is velocity. Shoot me in the face.
This is why our industry needs coaching.
Well, actually, if you look at number two, it's actually iteration burndown, which is just another form of velocity. It's just the inverted velocity, right?
If you look at the top four, that's what happens when you have leadership and project management that's used to a waterfall type project. One of the four biggest ones: velocity, iteration burndown, release burndown, plan versus actual. Those are shit metrics all the way around. You can't measure anything effectively with that. Those are just fake numbers. It's fake news, right? It's alternative facts. And the fact that those are so high on that list shows you have a lot of people who haven't, to Lev's point, Lev talked a lot about adopting the Agile mindset. They haven't adopted the Agile mindset yet. They're still trying to use Agile to frame their waterfall expectations.
Well, they need something to support the lie, right? They're not looking to be transparent. They want to support the lie. So it's always interesting when you get a group of program managers and project managers, after you give them the real numbers, they take those, manipulate them, put them in a PowerPoint, and they look completely different, right? Because this is what we're communicating, because we can't actually communicate the truth. We need to support the lie that we already sold.
Speaking about supporting the lies, I think we should petition version one to add red, yellow, green indicator to the list of options next year.
But I will say this, it was interesting. Cusack, early on in my journey, had a very interesting conversation with a group, and he said, well, what if the team has stable velocity sprint over sprint over sprint? Is that better than actually having increasing velocity sprint over sprint over sprint? And what do you think the answer was?
They're both wrong. Anyway.
Well, I'd rather have a team predictable and show and understand what they can deliver than constantly raising the number and never meeting it.
And somewhere a safe angel grew her wings.
And described my marriage.
I like two things. And the first is the cynical. I like that earned value is on the list. What the hell? We learned nothing in the last 25 years. And two, cycle time actually made the list, but lead time didn't. So, It is kind of cool that folks are starting to look at cycle time as a metric.
Business value is 23%, right? Is that how I read that? That's fucking terrible, right? Business value is not how we're measuring success. Like, isn't that the point of what we do?
God, note to self, do not send this recording to my mother. She's not going to like the use of language.
Right, I need to clean it off. My apologies.
It's fine, but just listen, my mom's going to call you.
We'll fix it in post. With that being said, I think we pretty much just going to wrap it up. I will give one final shout out to whoever on page 17 it has recommended Agile project management tools. 39% of the respondents said IBM Rational Doors. I am on Twitter at Backdoor Agile. Please tweet me and give me an answer as to why you would recommend IBM Rational Doors. That is it looks like most of the girls I hooked up with in college, where after a couple of beers, it's great, but sober, it's coyote time, dude. I'm chewing my arm off. That being said, anybody have anything to shout out? Anything? Andrew, Jason, Ryan?
I'm just ashamed. There's so much shame.
No, you know what? I think this has been a great conversation. I love the fact that, you know, we're sitting here talking about what may happen behind closed doors and not afraid to actually expose it. So, you know, kudos to the group for really sort of putting it out there and putting yourself out there. So if you are wet, you know, if your appetite is wet from sort of this sort of conversation, you know, hit us up on the coalition. We really want to hear the feedback.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Somewhere Jason is still yelling into his phone about Jira.
Well, first go. What's funny is that the client that I'm at right now also uses Doors. So you can imagine.
I would rather do my own vasectomy. And with that, I want to thank all of our listeners. Thank everybody who's been active on the coalition. It's been great. Thank you for the feedback. Thank you for the positive responses in iTunes. If you like what you're hearing, please comment. Please give us good ratings. It helps us show up higher in the search results. We appreciate your time and your effort. Once again, on behalf of Jason Cusack, Andrew Leff, Ryan Lockhart, and myself, I want to thank all of our listeners. Have yourself a great evening, and we will speak again shortly.